This is issue number 798 of the Secret Identity Podcast, and today in What's New, we're going to talk about Deadpool, Riverdale, Black Panther, New Mutants, and more. Our comics this week will be Lazaretto number 1, Falcon number 1, and Amazing Spider-Man Renew Your Vows number 9. And our BoobTube and Big Screen Bonanza comes back this week with Blade Runner, Close Encounters, The Flash, Arrow, and more.
Before we get started, does anyone want to get out?
The Human Torch was denied a bank loan.
This is all your fault, you.
Get that finger out of your ear. You don't know where that finger's been.
Why do you keep staring at me?
You have 20 seconds to comply.
And welcome everybody to Secret Identity. This is Brian Letendry, as always, with the lovely, the talented, the beautiful, the Archie clad Matthew A. Herring today. How are you, sir?
I'm doing really well. And one of my favorite shirts. It combines
I love that shirt.
My love of the Ramones.
Yeah.
Because it's that Ramones logo where instead of the eagle in the middle and the names going around it in a circle, it is the Archie characters.
Well, you know what? That's a great segue into our first news story, Matthew, because our first news story is about Riverdale.
See how we don't plan these things and it just happens?
The CW may not have technically won Wednesday night, it placed fifth, but the network staged a bit of a ratings coup with the return of Riverdale. The dark teen drama based on Archie Comics earned series-high returns, a 0.8 rating among adults 18 to 49 and 2.3 million viewers. Those are respective jumps of 60 and 57% compared to its original premiere in January.
Hmm.
So a 60% jump. Better still for Riverdale, it marked the CW's most watched telecast among teenagers since the heyday of the Vampire Diaries in 2012.
Wow. That is super good to hear that.
It says Riverdale's growth seems to be a fairly clear boost from the heavy online sampling earlier in the year and allegedly huge Second Life on Netflix. The drama, which landed on the streamer at the end of the first season's run, is said to have been a substantial hit. Network execs have hoped for these kinds of sophomore lifts from aggressive online releases, but this is the first time there's been any significant evidence of such a strategy having an impact on linear ratings. Now, I thought that was awesome because, if I remember correctly, the first season of Riverdale was on Netflix almost immediately.
Yes.
After it ended its run on the CW, which just shows you how freaking smart, because if you're like us, I know for me, if someone says to me, oh man, have you been watching this show? First of all, I can't even keep up with the shows I am watching over the course of a season. But if you tell me like, whatever, Game of Thrones has been amazing this year and it's the second to last episode, I'm not jumping in right now.
Yeah.
I am going to wait until it comes out on Netflix and then I'll watch the whole thing or something like that. So for Riverdale, I feel like what happened last year was people like us, people who were Archie fans, people who stumbled across it were evangelizing the show. It's amazing. You got to watch it. You got to check it out. If you like Twin Peaks, if you like some of this other stuff, like check it out. And so people finally did when it hit Netflix and were ready for season two.
Yeah, it's a lot like a movie that does not do well in the theaters.
For sure.
And then like right away. And when we were younger, going back into the 80s when cable was really at its infancy, you would have a movie leave the movie theater and you would have to wait 3 or 4 months before it would hit cable. And if it was a big movie like Star Wars, I remember the big deal when Star Wars finally hit cable after probably 10 years. But it's one of those things where the word of mouth on this show, I think, was so strong, it really pushed it. Because if you think about all the other shows that we watch, even Flash,
yep,
first season Gangbusters, second season Letdown.
Right.
And it was a letdown somewhat in story. And I think it also was a letdown in the excitement that was around it because people weren't talking about it. The same with Gotham. People weren't talking about it like they were. And like you said, we were evangelizing that show from day one because it's insane. And the first two episodes of the season, you saw the first, you did not see the second.
I did not see the second yet, but the first one, I think we mentioned it. And the thing about the first episode of that season is so much story.
Yeah, so I will tell you this right now. The second episode is just as much. Yeah. I described it to somebody yesterday as, I said, so far this season, every episode has ended with, no, Luke, I'm your father.
Yeah.
And you're like, holy crap, I need to know what's going on.
Yeah.
This episode, I dare say this episode this week is probably as insane an ending as any other ones that we have seen.
Well, I think one of the coolest things, and again, not having seen it, and we'll talk about it when we get to our boob tube later, was the Black Hood.
Oh,
the comic book character, the Black Hood, is now appearing in Riverdale.
And when they threw the Braveheart, I can't think of the character's name. But when Archie was going to save the day, and Jughead's, what do you think you are? Something Braveheart, which is a character that when they tried to make the Archie character superheroes, that was Archie's superhero. So they're throwing a lot of the nods in. And, and it's interesting because in this episode, you see a lot more flashbacks of the Black Hood. It is the same exact mask that the Black Hood wears.
And was he a cop?
He was a cop.
He was a cop that got like disfigured, right?
Yep.
Or something like that. Yeah. Okay. So it'll be interesting to see if that's what that is. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
As opposed to the
just throwing the name
But just the
around.
Fact that they're putting the name in there is kind of awesome too. So that was cool Riverdale news. Now, we had a couple of trailers drop this week. One was the new Black Panther trailer.
I did not see it yet.
Holy crap, dude. That movie is going to be amazing. And it still, if I'm not mistaken, like you still don't know what Andy Serkis, like his main thing is that he is coming to Wakanda for. I mean, is it vibranium? I don't know. But this one was more focused on what is going on inside of Wakanda.
Yeah.
And the challenges that T'Challa is going to face sort of inside as opposed to from the outsiders. And so that was kind of a nice contrast to the last one. Plus, and I feel like now I have to go on media blackout, and I feel the same way about Star Wars and the next one that I'm going to talk about in a second. Just a glimpse of some of the action scenes and some of the effects around his suit and stuff like that. Amazing.
Yeah.
It just looks freaking amazing. So that looks crazy awesome. And then the trailer for New Mutants dropped this week, which is basically a freaking horror movie.
Wow.
And I think they're actually going to market it as a horror movie. And I'm pretty stoked about that.
Yeah. New Mutants was they were the team that I got into because they were the X-Men were already established. There was no way I was going to get myself in. And this is like at the heyday of the comic book stores, because I remember having to go get the Marvel graphic novel number 4, I believe it was, with the first appearance of the New Mutants at a comic book store, which was Moondance at the Hampshire Mall in Hadley, Connecticut, or Hadley, Mass. And that team was like the team that I felt like, oh, this is my X-Men because I'm here at the beginning.
See, and I was never big into New Mutants, but what it seems like is that there's 5 core characters of this New Mutants team, and they are being held in some type of facility, almost like a residential treatment facility or a psychiatric facility. And there is a doctor there who is either putting them through like experiments or whatever, but basically it's about them being trapped there and figuring out what's going on there and trying to get out of there. And it was presented, the trailer is a very sort of dark and horror themed trailer, and it looks freaking awesome.
When's that one come out?
I don't even know what the release date is on it. I just know that it ran in front of Blade Runner, which we'll talk about in a little while, and it's been online this week. But that looks awesome too. So a couple of pretty awesome Marvel movies coming. Also, some news about some more Marvel movies, Deadpool 2 and Dark Phoenix. With the New Mutants trailer now online, we've got news for 20th Century Fox's Marvel movies as filming for Fox releases Deadpool 2 and X-Men Dark Phoenix wrapped on Saturday. So this was a week ago now, the filming on Deadpool 2 and on Dark Phoenix wrapped. Ryan Reynolds took to Facebook and made the Deadpool 2 announcement along with photos that you can view online. He said, "That's a wrap on Deadpool 2, A Song of Fire and Ice." Thank you to our beloved captain, Mr. David Leitch. Words are too clumsy to properly acknowledge your giant heart and talent. I already miss being on set, which is why I've decided to continue shooting the film in my underwear from Josh Brolin's well-appointed living room. Hashtag maximum effort. Let's see. Ryan Reynolds is reprising his role as the Merc with a Mouth alongside Zazie Betts in Luck-Manipulating Mutant Domino as Luck-Manipulating Mutant Domino and Josh Brolin as Cable. That movie's going to be amazing. X-Men Dark Phoenix writer, director, and producer Simon Kinberg also posted to Instagram that filming completed on that film. That will bring back the cast of X-Men Apocalypse, including James McAvoy, Michael Fassbender, Jennifer Lawrence, Nicholas Holt, Alexander Shipp, Ty Sheridan, who plays Cyclops, and Cody Smith McPhee, who does Nightcrawler. Jessica Chastain will play the villain in the film, while Sophie Turner will reprise her role as Jean Grey in the film, the host of the Phoenix Force. So let's see. Oh, New Mutants, as you just mentioned, Matthew, opens on April 13th of 2018.
Okay.
So that's coming in the spring. Deadpool 2 hits theaters on June 1st, 2018, less than 2 months later. And X-Men Dark Phoenix is scheduled for November 2nd, 2018. So 2018, a lot of X movies coming out.
Very good.
Yeah, so that's pretty cool. And I'm interested to see what they do with Dark Phoenix. We talked about that, right? We did that as a summer reading project.
Yep.
I think we did. And I've liked what they've done for the most part with the X-Men First Class run of movies. I thought Apocalypse was decent.
That was the thing. Like First Class was one of the best of the whole run so far. I probably enjoyed that one more than anything just for that whole Cold War feel. And you were able to bring everybody back. And Days of Future Past kind of stabilized everything. And that was a brilliant movie. And then you had Apocalypse, which I think fell flat in a few areas, but for the most part, I enjoyed it. I thought it was a very good movie.
To me, I think if there was one thing that it struggled with is that like there wasn't enough for all of the cast to do because it was a big cast, like Psylocke, who Olivia Munn played Psylocke, and she didn't have a ton of time with that character. You know what I mean? So it'll be interesting to see what they do with the next one. But yeah, I mean, the wave of superhero movies ain't slowing down anytime soon.
It's not slowing down.
And so, and we have Thor coming, what is it, next week?
Next week.
As we record this, and early reviews that I've been reading this week have been extremely positive. And then after that, Justice League hits, is it November or December?
I think that's November, and then Star Wars is December.
Yeah, it's crazy. Which again, to go back to what I said earlier, I am now on media blackout for Star Wars. I started watching the most recent trailer for the Star Wars movie and stopped. Because it's too, they're giving away too much.
Yep.
And I must be getting old now because that's where I'm at with this stuff is as soon as I start seeing spoilers from the movie being given away, I'm like, oh, no, I already know I'm going to go see that.
Yeah,
I know I'm going to see all of these movies.
Yes. The Star Wars thing was interesting because being a huge Star Wars fan like myself, people are grabbing onto every little piece, every little clue. This is what it would have been like if there was social media when in between Empire Strikes Back, Return of the Jedi. It would have been insane where everybody's going, oh my gosh, this is the clue that's holding this together. There was a figure that came out recently of Rey, and it's like a dark training Rey. So the coloring in it of the figure, and I don't know if it was the photo, the way they took it, or this is the actual figure, but the hood and everything, it looked like Senator Palpatine. So now everybody's jumping on the fact that Rey is Palpatine's daughter.
Oh, interesting.
So I think to me, honestly, and I'm sorry I just now ruined your media blackout.
Yeah.
I think of everything that I have read and heard so far, that is the one that I think really, really, really would capture me if that was true. Because right now they've made it too it's like, oh, you know what? It's going to be her kid. I've heard Obi-Wan's
relative.
That's too easy.
You're hoping that whatever you've assumed that it is or all the different theories out there, that it's something we haven't thought of yet.
Yeah, because I, as a Star Wars fan, will be the first to admit those movies have plot holes and script issues.
Like what's the new
all over the place.
What's the new Emperor guy's Snoke?
Snoke.
Yeah. So my theory is that he is Anakin Skywalker.
And that was my theory is that he is the Force,
because at the end of Return of the Jedi, they burn Vader's body on a pyre, right?
Yes.
What if, just saying, what if he didn't totally burn?
See, I thought it was Darth Vader's dark force ghost, because they don't say anything about the dark side not having ghosts. Like you have Obi-Wan, Yoda, they all got ghosts. Could be his force ghost. What was the other one that I heard?
I love that we're going down the rabbit hole and stuff. Like,
but we've got some theories. So there's another one, but we'll just keep going.
So last thing I want to mention for the news, two quick things. Number one is the BingCon is coming up on the 28th of October. Matt and I will be at Trinity United Methodist Church on Sumner Avenue in Springfield all day, along with many of our friends.
Yes.
It is our really like hometown, like legitimately very close
this
to where
we live. This is our home show.
This is our home show. So we're very excited about that. And another thing I'm excited about, if you go over to Drive-Thru RPG now, one of my all-time favorite settings ever for role-playing games is now back in print. And it's called The Scarred Lands. And when – I don't know if I ever told this story, but being a big D&D nerd, like I buy tons of role-playing books now, even though I hardly ever get a chance to play anymore. I still have – my bookshelves are filled mm-hmm. with all of these books. And Kickstarter over the past few years has become this – renaissance of tabletop role-playing games that are getting brought back in hardcover format with new stuff and everything. So Scarred Lands, when D&D 3.0 came out and the big D20 revolution came, White Wolf used to put out a setting called the Scarred Lands. And there were probably 40 books that came out for this particular setting back in the day, and I bought all of them. They're all on my bookshelf at home. I adored this setting. It was my second favorite RPG setting ever behind Dragonlance, which is my all-time favorite. And there has been a revival of Scarred Lands. Kickstarter campaign, the books were funded. They were up. The rules were updated to both Pathfinder role-playing game and the 5th edition of D&D. And now you can get those in print and also PDF form over at DriveThruRPG. So as a lifelong fan of that particular world, I am super, super, super excited that that is back. And who knows, maybe someday down the road, I'll get to contribute something to that world.
That'd
you know, that's the great
you.
Thing about these things coming back is that now there's new anthologies and there's new gaming supplements being put together and there's open calls for writers and stuff like that. And a bucket list item for me is being able to contribute to a role-playing game product, because I did play testing back in the day. I even wrote a couple of adventures that were kind of used in some play testing stuff, but never had an actual published game supplement. So I'm very excited to see all of these things coming back, because it's just more opportunities to do something like that. So there you go. That is your news for this week. And before we get into our books, we of course have to talk about facial hair, because it's that time of year, Matthew. I noticed that your goatee is going strong. You've
yep.
shaved down the sides.
I trimmed up the sides.
Which was to be expected. That's what's going to happen.
Yep.
But you are rocking the goatee. I am now rocking the goatee, and I'm sort of in this in-between of, do I bring the beard back? Or do I just go with the goatee for a while? I haven't decided yet, but the weather is starting to turn, and that's usually when I go into beard mode. So I'm going to assume that probably in the next couple of weeks, the beard will be making a comeback.
It's very funny, because I've noticed that when I leave the house now, it's my wallet, my cell phone, and my little tin of beard balm from
yes.
Viking Oils. It sounds like so weird and silly, but that's the way it is. And I've told Gary this story, and I think you noticed it for the first time in my brand new car.
Yes.
I had the car for a day, and I had my tin of Viking Oils on the seat. And because it got so hot out, it melted.
Yep.
So I now have like an oil stain. You got this brand new car.
Oil stain.
And you looked at it, you're like, oh, I'm like, Dad, that's dry. Don't
thing
even
is,
worry
though,
about
you can spin that, because now your new car is Viking Oils branded.
It is. And this is
it's
right after.
It's the Viking Mobile now.
This is right after I said to him, yeah, I don't need the I don't need that Rust-Oleum coating on
my
seats.
I don't need the undercoating. I don't need all
I don't
these
need
extra.
That crap.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Well, guess what? I probably did.
You probably did. But so go to VikingOilsLLC.com, get yourself some beard products for the wintertime, or pick some up for a loved one
yep.
as a stocking stuffer.
It fits perfectly.
Just don't leave
in
it
the
on the front seat of
yes.
the car in the sun all day long.
Yep.
So there you go. All right. Well, it's time to get into comics. And as we get into comics today, I am going to start us off today with a book from Boom. It's called Lazaretto. And it is the first issue of this series, written by Clay McLeod Chapman, illustrated by Jay Levong, lettered by Adita Bidikar, edited by Eric Harburn. And we start off on the very first day of school for Yersin University. It's move-in day at college. So you've got all these students who maybe are returning students who are on the courtyard. And it brought me back, because I remember like first year at Westfield State College, being the nervous freshman.
Yep.
Going in, you know, with my big trunk full of stuff and moving stuff up. Meanwhile, like the sophomores and juniors and seniors, they were already out hanging out, you know, getting their tan on the front lawn
yep.
and, you know, hanging out on campus and games of football and frisbee and all this other stuff going on. And I was like in this whole completely different world. So we start off and you see this dorm where there's like a courtyard and you have a family who are walking their son, Charlie, to the dorm. And dad saying, you know, the mom saying, you know, call us if you need anything. We're only a few hours away. Take care of yourself. We're always thinking of you. And dad saying, you know, remember what we talked about. You're not here to fool around. You got to stay focused, all this kind of stuff. And as they're having that conversation, you notice like a person walk by in the background and they're coughing. And then someone makes a comment about the canine flu. And so this guy, this kid Charlie, he's got all of his boxes. He goes up to his room, and then we cut over to Tamara, who's another young woman who is going to college for the first time. She lived in a very small community. She was homeschooled. This is her basically going out into the big wide world, and her dad is there, and he's saying, look, you know, you're going to be fine. This is an adventure you're about to go on. You know, if you're ever feeling lonely, just don't forget to pray. Like, you'll, and I'm here and all this kind of stuff. And so the dad's kind of trying to give her a pep talk, and her new roommate shows up, Mary. And Mary comes in, and it's clear right away that Mary and Tamara are from two very different worlds, right? So you have her being very nervous about what she's sort of gotten herself into. She starts walking around campus, and she's being handed flyers, and there's all the – there's partying going on, and it's like this complete overwhelming moment of the activity that's happening around her is – exponentially greater than any time in her entire life up until this point. And I also remember going into college and just like the first or second day walking around campus and just being like, this is like a city now.
Uh-huh.
This is like its own universe. And you were just at Westfield State yesterday because you were there for a con that the bookstore was throwing on there. And it's just like you enter into this bubble where like everything is self-contained. Like, There's places to eat on campus. There's the CAF. There's like, you know, pop-up restaurants and stuff like that. You've got the campus center where you can buy stuff. You only have to venture into town for like the necessities, or if you want to go out like recreationally.
Yeah.
But you could exist on campus for months at a time.
It's its own ecosystem.
It is its own ecosystem. And I think they did a really nice job in the beginning of this book of capturing like for – you know, for some of us, like I was a Catholic school kid through sixth grade, and then I went to public middle school. And when I did, that was my transition of like from the kind of sheltered existence to, you know, jumping into that. And that was a big adjustment for me. And then going to college, again, I had lived in Enfield my whole life, and that was a very self-contained town. We used to joke that Enfield had one of everything.
Yes, it did.
You didn't have to go to any other town because any restaurant you could think of, there was one of those in Enfield. We had a mall in Enfield. We had game stores. We had sports stores. We had everything you would ever need in Enfield. And so I didn't go out of Enfield a lot until I went to college. And so the beginning of the book kind of captures that feeling of, you know, these kids who are going out into the world for the first time. And so now we go up to we go back to Charlie, and he is being met by his RA, his resident advisor, I believe is what that stands for, the person who basically runs the hall and is talking to all the freshmen, and he's handing out hand sanitizer and saying, hey, don't forget to wash your hands because, you know, people are getting sick and stuff like that. But, you know, you guys all look like you're really scared. I'm here to, you know, to kind of shepherd you along. Don't worry about it. And you can see again that Charlie's like completely overwhelmed. Charlie goes to his dorm room, finds out his roommate is a pothead who is also a dealer. And the roommate's like, oh, you're going to be cool with this, right? Like, don't rat on me or anything. Or, you know, we might have guests coming through the room and stuff like that. And Charlie's like, dude, I did not sign up for any of this. Which also brought me back to when I went to my first year of college. We were in a triple. So we were in a three-person room, which was cool in one way because it's a bigger room than the other rooms that most kids get in the hall. But I was rooming with two best friends. So these guys who went to high school together, had known each other for years, moved here, and I'm the third wheel in that equation. And it ended up being great, actually. We ended up becoming great friends and stuff like that. But I remember my first day being like, these guys already know each other. I don't know either one of them. Like, it was just so he's, again, for him and for Tamara, both of them are in a situation where this is not the immediately smooth transition that they were kind of hoping for. So we go back to Tamara's room, and her roommate, Mary, is not feeling well. And so Tamara's like, you know, I was going to go out and check where my classes are and stuff like that. And Mary's like, yeah, go on without me. You know, I'm fine. I'm just going to keep setting up my room and stuff like that. But you can see she's getting really sick and she's starting to cough up blood. So you have this sort of balance in this book between this first big experience at college for these two particular kids against the backdrop of what feels like the first 25 to 30 minutes of a horror movie, where you can see that something's about to happen and go horribly wrong. And that is, in fact, what's happening. But before that happens, Tamara goes up to the rooftop of the dorm just to be alone and get some fresh air. And she runs into Charlie up there. And the two of them end up having a conversation about how, like, yeah, I'm not – this is really kind of not what I thought it was going to be so far. And it's not that great. And, you know, this is our first night of freedom. And the two of us just want to go home, you know. And so they did a good job of capturing that. And then by the next morning – things have started to sort of escalate a little bit around campus. And you could see, it's almost like the beginning of Shaun of the Dead, where you could kind of see in the background, some people are not okay anymore and stuff like that. But no one's fully like turned into, you know, whatever they're going to turn into here. But like Tamara goes to the caf, and even the people making the food are coughing now and stuff like that. So she's totally grossed out and she's not going to eat anything there. And then they end up going to class, and Charlie and Tamara are in the same class, and it's in a lecture hall. And Tamara's roommate, Mary, comes stumbling in, and she is like full on sick at this point. She, you know, she's bleeding from her nose. She's coughing and stuff like that. And she ends up collapsing. And as the teacher goes to help her, she's coughing all over this guy and blood's coming up and stuff. And so you could see that whatever this sickness is now starting to spread. And so Tamara and Charlie end up running out of that building. They run across campus to their dorm. And when they get there, they're already seeing these government agents in the biohazard suit showing up and putting the entire place on quarantine. And as the first issue ends, the two of them are now sort of trapped inside their dorm as it's being sealed up because there's some sort of outbreak kind of going on. And so what impressed me about this book is that it wasn't just an outbreak story. It wasn't just a potential whatever, if it's going to be a zombie story or something like that. It really did a good job of capturing that whole first day at college, man, things are totally overwhelming. Luckily, I did not have to deal with some sort of epidemic as I was at my first day at school. I could just be overwhelmed by the fact that I was now living in this completely new ecosystem. But yeah, it struck a nice balance. So Lazaretto number one, definitely worth checking out. Another interesting and entertaining book from Boom.
Very nice. So I completely forgot the order. So what book do I got next?
You are going to do Falcon number one.
So one of those books that I was swearing to stay away from. I said, I don't need this. I do not want to read something, not like it, and then feel like I just got cheaped, feel like I got robbed, feel like I got sucked into something.
Now, if I'm not mistaken, if I could just ask a quick question about this. So Sam has now ceased being Captain America, and he is going back to being Falcon. Is that where we're at in the legacy timeline now?
That is exactly where we are, Brian. Okay. That's a very good one. So Rodney Barnes is the writer. Joshua Cassara is the artist. Rachel Rosenberg, the colors. Joe Caramagna does the letters.
Man, that guy's everywhere.
Jesus Saez does the cover art. And then I would be here for 4 hours reading all the variant cover artists that were on here.
Yeah.
I did not get my choice of any. And then the Falcon costume is designed by Alex Ross, which as I was flipping through it and looking at the writing team on it, I saw that and thought, you know what, I'm definitely going to give it more of a chance than just looking at it. So this is number one of the Falcon. So as you said, Brian, Falcon used to be Captain America. He gave it up and he worked with the Avengers. He is under a little bit of scrutiny right now because people every time they see him are like, yeah, you didn't know Captain America was a traitor? And they're like, he wasn't. That was not the same dude. But it is the guilt by association. It is the guilty until proven innocent that they really push in this story.
Well, and it's the believe the headline, not the facts.
Yes, which I really, really – I didn't like it because it was not good, but I liked it because it's a great way to start a story.
Pretty accurate to the society that we live in today.
Yeah, Bad Kid, Mad City is the name of it. And you've got Falcon flying around whose new base now is in Chicago.
Okay.
And he's flying around with Red Wing because, again, if you want me to read a Falcon book, bring back his old costume, which I doubt they'll ever do. Make sure Red Wing's there, which they do right
page one. Didn't Nightwing go to Chicago in Rebirth?
I think so, yeah. Or he went to – oh, he went to – it's not Bloodhaven anymore. Yeah, I don't even know where he went because I'm not even reading it, not even reading Nightwing.
Not that they'd run into each other.
No. So you've got these kids on the floor, and the art in here by Joshua has a very – I mean, there's panels where it looks like very Richard Corbin-y.
Oh.
And the colors look like it too. But the people aren't as shapely and the lines aren't as clean and crisp. It's a very stylized art, but there were moments in here where I saw them, like in these particular panels, and you know the way the shadowing is used of people looking in cars and looking outside windows, very Corbin-y. And I'll show you really quick. You can maybe see a little of that feel. So you've got these dudes that see somebody in a car and they're like, "Yep, smoke them." So as they're ready to get to shoot some people, Red Wing comes down, grabs the gun. Falcon comes down and jumps on the hood of the car, stopping the car, which I'm like three pages in. I'm like, holy crap. I'm really liking where this is going. So he jumps on the car, gets the bad guys out. The two dudes that were being shot at run down the alley, and they escape. So Falcon is there kind of talking to the press, talking to the guys that were shooting, going, do you realize that you could have killed innocent people? And you don't seem to understand that part. And the guys aren't even talking. So in his inner monologue, he's talking about how there is no respect for anything anymore, that people in this city especially, people are just looking to kill each other. And if you're not part of us, we're going to get rid of you. And this is that whole mentality that people are living by. And then the mayor all of a sudden shows up and he's like, oh, Falcon, you know, so good to see you. And thank you so much for everything that you've done for helping us to help the great citizens of this area. And Falcon's like, hey, you know what? First of all, you got a gang problem here. This is something that needs to be fixed. And every time something bad happens and you have these meetings about it, all you're doing is making it worse because you're not taking care of the situation. You've got the police in here who are overworked and undermanned, and basically says everything wrong for a mayoral candidate because he's running for office right now, or he's running for re-election. So he's doing everything wrong to do this guy. But what I loved about this too is that the story automatically right away brings in the fact that the police are there to help. And it isn't the bad cops that are doing stuff, which, you know, we've got friends that are cops. I'm very sensitive to that. I get more sensitive to people making comment about how cops are all crooked and wrong and bad more than probably anything else going out there. So I love the fact that Falcon was even saying, these guys are overworked. We need to do something to help them and to protect them. And the mayor's like, yeah, thanks a lot for that one. Falcon takes off and he gives that little wince like, oh, I'll take care of you. And he's also wearing a tie clasp that has some sort of emblem on it that I don't recognize, but it seems like it could be bad. They're focusing on it. It's bad news.
Oh, the mayoral candidate?
Yeah, he belongs to something. Okay. So now Falcon's flying around and he's talking to somebody and you find out it's the new Patriot. And the Patriot's a young black kid and he is, he's on the computer, he's on his laptop talking to Falcon saying, let's do this, let's get together, I love what you did. Because he's sort of his eyes and ears on the ground, much like Falcon was for Cap and much like they worked for each other. So, you know, the Patriot's like, so let's get together and we'll talk about a plan. And Falcon's like, look, this isn't the way this relationship goes. And then all of a sudden you see a jet, like an Avengers jet, land in front of Falcon. And he's like, really, Sean? And he gets out and he's like, look, we're supposed to be a team. We can help each other. I'm not wearing a costume just so you can have me give you directions. I'm part of your team. And he's like, where'd you get the jet? That's not a concern of yours. I am here right now because I want to help you. And he's like, okay, I've got an idea. Let me work on this one, and I'm going to need your help. So he ends up bringing him in as a legit hero. He's going to have him help out. Falcon goes in. There's two gangs that are running this area of Chicago, and one's a black gang and one's a Latino gang. So you've got basically the two warring factions. You've got the gang go in. They pull all their guns, and the head of this gang is like, what are you doing here, Birdman? I love the fact that you're back and you're representing your people, but you know what? You don't represent me and you don't represent all these guys. And Falcon goes into a speech of, you know, I know what it's like to live like this. And he gives him sort of his backstory, explains a lot of stuff. And he says, you know, we can make this a great neighborhood. And I know that you've got issues and problems with the other gang, but we can do this because innocents are dying. And you've got a lot of your gang members here that are going to die or they're going to go to jail. And this is what we're trying to stop. And that's the social worker in Sam Wilson coming out. And the gang leader is like, yeah, guess what? No, we're not doing this. And then a couple of gang members behind go, yes, we want this. We don't want to live this life anymore. We want to have the things and the opportunities, but this is not going to work in this situation. So Falcon's like, look, I've got most of your people that want to change. So the gang leader reluctantly agrees to meet with this other gang. And they said, we're going to meet in a public park. We'll meet in the park. We'll do this. We'll lay it all out. It'll be all in the open. So nothing will happen. And Falcon, of course, says, you've got my word. Nothing will happen. That's the bad part. So then you got the Patriot who shows up to the Latino gang. He walks in, they start shooting at him. He puts a shield up, throws a shield, hits the gun out of a girl's hand. Shield comes back. He elbows some dude in the head, knocks him down. And then their gang leader comes out and he's like, what do you want? And he goes, I want, and he basically gives the same speech Falcon does, says, you know, this is not the way we want to live. I'm the Patriot. I'm fighting for you guys so we all can have a really good world and a good country and a good city and the places, and we can have lives that enrich and add something to this. So back at City Hall, Falcon goes up and sits with the mayor and says, okay, here's the deal. I've got both gangs meeting at the park at like 7 o'clock. I need extra police. I need this. I need that. And we can fix this whole problem. And the mayor's like, well, you're not a cop. You don't order the cops. As far as I'm concerned, you have no jurisdiction anywhere. You ought to maybe just go back to New York. And he goes, I'm not giving you extra cops. And I'm also telling you that if something bad happens, this is all on you. Every bit of this. So Falcon and the Patriot are walking and they're talking about what they're going to do, how they're going to do this. Falcon gives the young man his story. And then we go to the park and you see the park where all the gangs are showing up. And as Falcon's at the podium talking and you see all the gangs are kind of like that scene in the Falcon and the Warriors. We've just got mobs of gang people, and they're all kind of interspersed with each other. Falcon is saying, you know, I'm bringing your leaders to the podium, and we're going to fix this. We're going to make this right. So as they go around the corner, the Latino gang member puts out his hand to shake it, and the black leader pulls out a gun, shoots him right in the head in front of everybody. And obviously, insanity and calamity happens. And then you find out that that was just a plant, that the gang leader, that you don't know if he was a plant all along or he's part of this whole huge plot. But basically, the issue ends with the mayor kind of gloating about, yep, see, this is what's going to happen. So we have no truce. We probably have more problems than we did good. It's just an all out mess of insanity. And one of the interesting pictures in here was, you have the cops in there trying to restore order. Falcon's in there trying to restore order. And you've got like younger gang members with their kids.
Yep.
That are at this thing because they're picking up their kids, grabbing them and getting them out of here. And that was sort of a very sad thing for me to see because I know that that's the reality of things in certain areas. So I think that this book is a lot better than just a comic book. It was one of these things that I read it and it made me socially aware of a lot of things going on that I have no clue about. And it also brought to light, there's a lot of things going on in this world that if we just had superheroes, we could fix. And also it kind of brought up the fact that people have their own agendas and this is why our world is in the mess that it's in, because people are not necessarily, you know, when you represent the people, they're not representing the people. They're representing their best interests. So a great, great, great book that I think has a whole different take on what I thought it would be. And if issue number one is a precursor to the way it's going to be, I will be in. The writing, fantastic.
Well, I'm going to stick with Marvel, Matthew, and I'm going to go over to Amazing Spider-Man Renew Your Vows for a storyline called The Venom Experiment. What has been happening in Amazing Spider-Man is they defeated in the beginning of the series Regent, who, if you remember, was a villain who had created technology that would siphon superheroes' powers. And he had like built a suit for himself that was going to, he could tap into different heroes' powers and stuff like that. And so in the wake of that, Spider-Man had taken a piece of his technology and adapted it into a suit where Mary Jane could basically access Spider-Man's powers. And so that allowed the two of them and their daughter to be superheroes together through this particular technology. But what MJ has seen lately is that when they're getting into these big fights and these things are happening, it is siphoning too much of Spidey's power. So in order for her to continue to be a superhero, she is putting Peter in situations where he becomes more vulnerable.
Mm.
And so she's trying to figure out how she can continue to do what she does without having to rely on him. And she ends up talking to Liz Allen, who is, She, what is the name of her company? It is Liz Allen. I think it's Allen Technology. And so Liz Allen, Allen Biotech, says to her, hey, I can help you out. I've been working on a new technology that is sort of, it enhances the person's strength and abilities and stuff like that. So I can give you similar powers with this new suit that I've been developing, and you won't have to tap into Peter's anymore. You won't have to use that Regent technology and all that kind of stuff. And so she accepts this new suit. Now, Matthew, this new suit that she gets from Liz Allen is black and white.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of is a darker version of the suit that she was wearing before. And it starts to not only enhance her strength and her speed and all that other kind of stuff, but it also enhances her aggressiveness.
Oh, boy.
And so as we open this story, you have her dropping off Annie at school and saying, you know, have a great day. You know, and Annie's kind of saying, what's with the new suit? I don't really like that suit. It's actually kind of scary. And so why are you wearing it now? And she's saying, oh, don't worry about it. You know, this is just a new costume, and we're just trying something new. And she drops Annie off, and she's like, I can't talk now. I got to go. And you see that her energy level is like so amped up. It's like she's had 15 cups of coffee. And so she spins out of there, and Peter happens to be swinging by, and he's like, where did that new suit come from? And why does that remind me of – and he and MJ haven't even talked about it yet. And so he decides to follow her. He's like, you know what? She's spinning around and my powers aren't even being tapped right now. So something's up with that suit. I'm going to follow her. So he ends up following her to a bank heist that's going down where you have three superpowered villains who are robbing an armored car, and Spinneret shows up, which is MJ's code name, and puts the smackdown on them. Like to the point where one of the guys, she is smashing his face into the ground and choking him out, and like he's going to die. And so Peter actually has to swoop in and like rip MJ off of this dude. And he's like, what the heck is going on? You're acting like a maniac. And he tries to calm down the crowd who's like, what the heck just happened here? And MJ kind of takes off. So now we cut to the Daily Bugle, and you've got J. Jonah Jameson, who's laughing at someone trying to tell him that there's a monster on the loose that's been attacking people. He's like, oh, yeah, great. Yeah, the monster's got big jaws and everything. I'm sure that's going to happen. Unless somebody gets me pictures, I'm not running this in the newspaper. We'll look like idiots. And as Peter's overhearing this conversation, because Betty was the one that was pitching the story to JJ, he says to her, can you tell me a little bit more about that? And as she's describing what it is, it sounds like Venom. And he's like, no, that's not good. This can't be MJ. This cannot be happening. So now we cut over to MJ's boutique store that she just recently opened. And you see that the person she has working for her, she's snapping at the person. She's becoming like a jerk now. Now we go to the hospital, and Spider-Man goes in to interview one of the more recent victims of this quote-unquote monster. And this person is describing this thing attacking him, and he's like, yeah, it was definitely female, like, and it had, you know, huge claws and almost ripped me apart and all this kind of stuff. So Peter is quickly coming to the conclusion that, holy crap, somehow MJ has the symbiote, which he thought was impossible, because also in this series, because again, this is sort of a parallel universe, he killed Eddie Brock. He like dropped a building on Venom, and Eddie Brock was dead, and they thought the symbiote was gone. He ends up finding Mary Jane in some part of the city, and she is literally at war with the symbiote that is trying to consume her. And so they go through this battle where, you know, she starts knocking the crap out of Peter, and then she has to have that internal struggle kind of in her own mind of her and the symbiote battling with one another. And of course, it knows Peter, and it knows Peter's darkest secrets, and, you know, it hates Peter. And so the rest of the issue is really about Mary Jane having to fight off the symbiote to escape from it. And she eventually is able to mentally overpower it, but she's not completely free of it. And so the issue ends with them trying to figure out how they're going to get this thing away from her and get her separated from the symbiote. And Peter's like, well, where did you even get this thing to begin with? And she's like, Liz Allen. Why? And then we cut back to Liz Allen, and her son Normie is kind of becoming like Norman Osborn.
Mm.
And you see Liz is right on board with him and is going to give the kid whatever he wants. And so one of the things that she was trying to do was cause Spider-Man's family to completely fall apart, so he would no longer be a distraction to them. And that's the way this issue ends. And so Mary Jane is still fighting with the symbiote, and this storyline is going to continue on. But I thought it was kind of cool to be able to see that whole storyline from a different perspective, you know, and to see some of these roles that we know in our current, you know, 616 universe be kind of flipped around a little bit. This book, as I mentioned before, has become my Fantastic Four book because it's that family.
It's the family.
Book. You've got the three of them. You've got Peter and MJ that are married. They have a child. All three of them are sort of superheroing together. It really has filled that Fantastic Four niche for me. And so I've really been enjoying it. This storyline is a little bit darker than what we've seen so far because so up until this point, things were kind of light and a little bit more whimsical, and this is definitely a dark storyline. So if you haven't checked out this book yet, man, definitely a good time to jump on because I've been having a lot of fun with it.
All right.
Well, there you go. That is our comics for this week, but we have much to still talk about, Matthew, because the Boob Tube and Big Screen Bonanza is back, and do you want to start with Close Encounters? Because I know you gave that a rewatch this week.
Yeah. I'm more curious about Blade Runner.
Okay. Well, let's talk about Blade Runner first. So Blade Runner 2049 recently came out in theaters. It's been out for about 3 or 4 weeks now. I did not get to see it the first week that it came out because I told myself that I was going to watch the original before I went out. I'll watch it again before I went out and saw the new one. And I'm so glad I did. First of all, I watched the final cut because I have the collection with all the different versions of the movie in it. So I watched the final cut. It still holds up amazingly well. That is a fantastic movie. And to then go into this movie and to see how much of a spiritual success, I mean, it's a sequel, obviously, but it is also such a spiritual successor to the look and feel of the original Blade Runner. And that to me was what, in so many ways, it is a parallel to the original Blade Runner. This movie is not an action movie, which really the original wasn't either. There were moments of violence and moments of action that punctuated a very sort of noir story and somber story. And that's what this movie is. And in this one, Ryan Gosling plays a replicant who is also a Blade Runner. And so you have now progressed 30 years, I believe, since the original movie, and a lot has happened. There was a series of short films and animated things that came out before the new Blade Runner, and it kind of told the story of what happened in the years in between. But basically, the replicants, they staged this attack in like, what was 2019? Was that the original Blade Runner?
I think so.
So not long after that, the replicants essentially ended up taking out with an EMP the databases of all the replicants that were stored in the city and also set off this huge EMP that basically shut everything down for a long time. And so what they did was kind of erased most of the history of the replicants so that it wasn't easy anymore to track down old replicants.
Because that's how they did it. They were hunting them down because they had a database.
And that whole thing got destroyed. And so then the dude who played the Joker – Jared Leto plays a new mogul who has taken the technology of the old Tyrell Corporation, I think it was, and I'm terrible with names, so forgive me that stuff. But basically, he is the new creator of replicants who has developed new replicants. But what he cannot do is he cannot create replicants that can reproduce. And so there is a rumor that there was a child that was born of a replicant, like actually born.
Mm-hmm.
And so the movie, one of the central plots of the movie is that Ryan Gosling's character is sent to find that child because if that gets out, that a human and a replicant were able to reproduce and have a child, that changes everything.
Yes, it does.
And so that becomes a real central point in the movie. And I don't want to give too much else away of that because that's established fairly early on that this is something they need to figure out more about. But what I will say is that Ryan Gosling, in my mind, was absolutely freaking amazing in this movie. What a perfect successor to Harrison Ford for the role that he's playing in this movie. Like, I cannot tell you how blown away I was by his performance, which really is very understated because he doesn't have a ton of dialogue. Mm-hmm. And for much of the movie, he's not overly emotional, but the way he carries himself, the body language, there is some real interesting themes in this movie just about the nature of artificial intelligence. What makes people human? A lot of the same questions that the first movie made you think about and ask yourself are very much explored in this movie, and it's very slow. It's almost 3 hours long. It takes its time. It's not in a rush to do anything. You know, you've seen by now the fact that Harrison Ford shows up in the movie. This movie is not about Harrison Ford for most of the movie. It is very much Ryan Gosling's story for the majority of this movie. And it's a tragic story, and it's an interesting story. And I just loved everything about it. When I went to the theater, there was probably five of us in the theater, which the sad part is this movie's not doing well at the box office.
Yeah.
It has not done well. It has not performed well. That's really unfortunate, although the original didn't perform well at the box office when it came out either. But if you loved the original Blade Runner, I cannot imagine that you would see this movie and have anything but love for it. I think if you were expecting this to be more of a sci-fi action thriller, you're going to be very disappointed with this movie, because it is not that. This is a very much a story-based movie and moves very deliberately. And I loved that because it didn't rush with anything. And the world is just, it's that world 30 years later. You know, it's just like so well done.
I was never a fan of the first one.
Really?
And it was, I remember seeing it.
Was it because of that? Because it wasn't what you thought it was going to be?
It might have been. But as a kid, because I was, boy. I mean, this was a few years after Star Wars. This was before Indiana Jones.
Yep.
I mean, a few years after Star Wars. So there was probably like 80 or 81 that this movie came out. So I was only about 10 or 11. And is it Andrew? Who's the writer?
Ridley Scott.
Producer, director, and
Philip K. Dick is the story that the movie came from. Androids Dream of Electric Sheep?
He is also the writer of Man in the High Castle, which it's based on his story, which I absolutely love.
Yeah.
So it made me want to go back to go watch it again. Now I remember seeing it in the theater. I had to talk my dad into it because it was rated R. Mostly because when the replicants died, it was a gross death. It was always shards of glass in the neck and stuff leaking out. So talked my dad into going to see it, did not like it. But when I saw the trailer for this one, I'm like, I need to go back and see the final cut, the last version. And I want to see this desperately. And I'm expecting it to be exactly what you said. I'm expecting it to be a Netflix or Amazon series just condensed into a movie, not dragged out. And, Phillips's work is like that. There's a lot more, like Man in the High Castle, if you're watching that, you're confused at every single turn. But as a young kid, I just wanted dudes shooting each other in space. That's all I wanted. And yeah. I was a huge Rucker Hauer fan. Joanna Cassidy, I believe, was one of the other.
Man, Rucker Hauer played such a good part in the first movie, just like his whole, the tragicness of his character.
Yes.
And I think in a lot of ways, Ryan Gosling's character in this one is even more of a tragic character than Rutger Hauer's character, except he's the main character in this one. It's so good. I freaking absolutely loved it. And I believe that's where I saw the New Mutants trailer, was in front of this movie. And I was like, holy crap, that looks amazing too. So yeah, it was really, really, really good. But you also revisited an 80s movie. Was Close Encounters before the 80s? It was 78, yeah.
So this 78, and it was funny because the 40th anniversary Blu-ray just came out, and I have always laid claim to this being one of my five favorite movies of all time.
Uh-huh.
This movie terrified me as a kid. I remember seeing it.
Terrified me too.
Seeing it during the day.
The kid opening the door burned into your mind forever, right?
Yep. The screws coming up from the floorboard. Yep, that whole thing with Barry is terrifying, every bit of it.
And mashed potatoes.
Yeah, that was always, I love that.
Mashed potatoes always.
And it's still one of those things where I guess we're kind of getting ahead about that. People don't even know anything about the movie. But in 1978, Steven Spielberg had the opportunity to make a science fiction movie because Star Wars was so big. Battlestar Galactica was on TV. Everybody was just screaming for anything sci-fi. So this is the story about aliens that have come to Earth over the last who knows how long. But in they describe it and take it as all those things that happened in the Bermuda Triangle, The Flight 19 out of Florida in 1945, boats that were missing, ships that never were found after they went in the Bermuda Triangle. They basically said it was these aliens that were taking them. And here we are. So some of these, like if you take the flight in 1945, 50, 60, 70, 80, so you're some 30 years later in the desert, all like 15 of these planes just show up. And they asked the locals, they're like, what's going on? And they're like, there was a light in the sky, there was music. And all of a sudden, these planes just showed up. And then they go somewhere else in the middle of the desert, they find a boat. So the aliens are returning everything, but they're putting them in the wrong spots. And the aliens are now looking all over the rest of the world, like they're in Indiana, which is where the majority of the story takes place. And anybody that comes in contact with them gets this sort of internal drive to find out more about them. Like Richard Dreyfuss is the main guy in this. I'm in the wrong Steven Spielberg movie.
Yep.
Richard Dreyfuss is the main guy who, when he is an electrician out because the aliens show up and there's blackouts everywhere, an alien ship flies over him and he kind of has this close encounter. And they describe it as the first encounter is a sighting. The second one is confirmation. And then the third one is contact. So he has had the confirmation. He's seen it. He's felt it. And he destroys his family because he now has this whole thing about Devil's Tower in his head, but he doesn't know what Devil's Tower is. And that is where the aliens are going to meet. This is where the aliens have been telling everybody, we're going to come to this place. You need to come. So the U.S. government's involved. There's a French scientist who's involved. And Richard Dreyfuss is so obsessed about everything. His family leave him. Terry Garr, a very young Terry Garr, takes the family, leaves because he's now building, he has shaving cream. He starts molding the sides to look like a tower. He does it with mashed potatoes at dinner. He makes a huge one in his living room, because he has a model train set. So he just builds a huge one right in the middle and is trying to explain to the neighbors, I'm fine. Don't worry about it. I'm all right. I'm okay. And he's clearly insane. So he and this other woman who has now lost her son get together. They venture to Devil's Tower, where the government has now put in this plot of, okay, we've had a nerve gas leak, so everybody in town's got to leave. So everybody's leaving. They go in. The aliens show up. They return all the people that they stole from the Bermuda Triangle. There is a scene that completely overwhelms me to this day, where these pilots are coming down, the ship opens up, they're coming down the gangplank of the ship, and they're going up and they're looking around like, we don't even know what happened. And you've got these guys going, this guy disappeared in 1945. He hasn't aged a bit. And then I remember as a young kid going, what about his wife? What about his kids? You know, that was where my thought was at the time. Yeah. And then you have like there's like three memorable things in this movie. One of them was the fact that you have like, after this is going on, you have these two guys talking and they're like, that kind of proves that Einstein's theory was correct. And then the guy looks at him, he goes, I think Einstein was one of them. And then the aliens finally come out and the first alien that you see is freaking terrifying because it is that Freddy Krueger elongated arms down the alley thing where it comes out and outstretches its arms. And it's creepy. And then the majority of the aliens, like that's sort of the leader of the queen. The majority of the aliens all come out and they're like little big headed kids with long fingers. And they're really cute and they're bouncing all over the place. But the movie, I think, still holds up. I watched it Friday on Blu-ray and I'm like, holy crap, this thing is still amazing. Everything about it, the special effects aren't necessarily the best because you can see that it was filmed on top of another screen and all that stuff. But I think that this movie is driven so strongly by plot, by characters, by situations that you can look past a lot of the silliness in the things. And I even started watching one of the commentaries, and where Steven Spielberg got this idea was he said he wanted it to be a Watergate meets Star Wars, where it's a government cover-up. And I'm like, holy crap, that's exactly what it was. Because if you think about this, we were only 4 or 5 years after Watergate, the biggest – up until then, like the biggest political embarrassment our country has ever had. And this movie is just so good. My pisser about the whole thing was they re-released it in the theater for a weekend and I didn't even know about it.
I know. I miss so many of those when they do those like Fathom events at the movie theater and stuff like that. I did see the Jaws one, you know, but other than that, like I miss them all the time. And you'll find out, oh, this was here last week. And you're like, son of a.
Yeah.
But yeah. Well, we revisited some old stuff, but let's touch on some new stuff before we wrap up the show. I did not see this week's Flash, but you did see this week's Flash.
So this Flash, and that was funny because watching the first Flash, the Samuroid.
Yeah.
I ran right downstairs. I'm like, oh my God, Flash, like 191. And the same picture where he held him up by the samurai sword, up by the uniform, to me is as that is iconic as, and I know people are going to cringe on this one, Electra getting shafted by Bullseye.
Oh.
As like those images on covers that have really, really, really stayed with me.
You're going to catch some heat for that.
Oh,
I don't think most people think it's that iconic.
Yes. So in this one, and I'm trying to even think of what happened because I'm completely.
Well, Barry's like back in his own mind now, right?
So Barry is back. Iris is still kind of struggling with a lot of all that stuff that is going on.
Now, I would assume she's struggling to come to grips with the idea that he left.
Yes. Oh, they're going to counseling.
Oh, okay.
So that's one of the things. I'm sitting there and I'm like, what the heck was the whole plot about? So Barry is coming to grips with the fact that he is faster than he's ever, ever been.
Right.
And Iris is now – there's issues because like the scene – the show starts with them waking up and Barry's already made breakfast and Iris is like, well, I got a whole lot of plans to get ready. And since Barry is still – running in his brain at the speed of the Speed Force, he's like, oh, don't even worry about it. I booked the hall. I picked out the thing. I got the cake that you liked, chocolate with blah, blah, blah. So he is already doing everything, and it is really starting to get Iris bent out of shape. So there's a lot of that tension going on. But I am completely forgetting what even oh, Kilgore. Oh, my gosh, that's what it was. So Kilgore was from the second Flash series with Barry at – with Wally West being the Flash – he was a computer virus in the days of when nobody even owned computers.
Yeah.
So you just assumed, oh, this is bad. So there were these four guys that created something, three guys and a woman. They created this thing and they turned their back on one of their partners and their partner is now coming after them by implanting these viruses in the tech. So they make the elevator go bad. It kills one of the guys. They try to screw around with one of the cars. One of the other creators of this has a insulin pump that all of a sudden he's now in and he overshoots her with insulin. So she goes into shock. And then it is Barry just trying to catch him. So there was a ton of nods to the past, which I really loved. And now you're seeing there is a central figure in this that is behind the scenes of all of this. You see the guy in the chair, who's pulling the strings on all of this.
Yep.
So I don't know who that is. Do you have any theories?
No.
Because he's sitting in a chair. I'm like, is that – was it the new god? Not Mobius.
Orion? It's not Orion, is it?
No, it would be – it's like Mobius or the Mobius chair.
Sure.
Something like that. But I'm – I mean, that's the only person I know that sits in a chair. So very, very interesting. I did not like the – I liked the season premiere, but – like you said, it's like all of a sudden it's way too fast. All of a sudden he's here, he's gone, he's back, and let's move on to a happier time. Half the cast is missing. Caitlin is kind of going back and forth between good and bad, so you're just waiting for her to snap.
Right.
But all in all, very excited about the show being back.
So I watch – you don't watch Arrow anymore, right?
No.
You haven't been watching Arrow. So I have been watching Arrow, and what has become a very key focus of this season is that Oliver's son, William, is now living with him because the mom was killed on Lian Yu, the island at the end of last season. There was a whole big thing. Deathstroke came back. There was – you know, the guy that was basically trying to – completely break down Oliver, had all of these plans in place. But the focus of this particular episode was that someone gave a picture of Oliver as the Green Arrow to a local news station. Oliver is now the mayor. And so all of a sudden, all over the news are these pictures of him dressed as the Green Arrow. So now there's an FBI investigation, and the FBI are coming in, and they're trying to establish that he is, in fact, the Green Arrow. He's saying that this somebody planted this, it's false, this kind of stuff. And you have William, who is struggling to adjust at school, knows that Oliver is the Green Arrow, sees him leaving every night, believes that he's not going to come back one night. And so the theme that's starting to develop for this season is that Oliver is going to have to make a decision to not be the Green Arrow anymore because he's afraid of orphaning his son by going out and getting himself killed and not coming back some night. And so he wants Diggle to take over the mantle of the Green Arrow. Now, Diggle in the explosion that happened at the end of last season, ended up catching some shrapnel, and because of that has nerve damage in his shooting hand. And so there have been a handful of missions so far in this season where he has gone out and like hasn't been able to protect his teammates, hasn't been able to fire his gun when he needs to, and he is becoming a liability to the team. So he was actually on his way to tell Oliver that he needs to take a break or something like that. And basically Oliver says to him, I need you to be the Green Arrow now. So Diggle is now going to step up and try to be the Green Arrow. Now, whether or not that's something he can do with the nerve damage that he has is remains to be seen, but he's now being asked to take on an even greater role with the team than he was planning on, which was to take a step back. And so that's kind of interesting, but at the same time, much like The Flash, they're kind of really jumping fast forward mm-hmm. with stuff that has happened from last season. And so I just, I don't know if they feel like they can't take time to develop some of these storylines that they really just need to push forward or what, but it feels like similar to what's happening with Flash, there's a very sort of brisk pace that's being set from this season of the show. And that might be very deliberate because maybe they felt like we dragged our feet, you know, last season a little bit too much and we really need to push forward. So I'm interested to see where it goes, obviously. And I've been enjoying it. My son and I have been watching it together. So we love Arrow, but it's interesting to see what happens this year. And anytime you bring the, anytime you give one of the main characters a new relationship, a child or something like that, it can go one of two ways.
Yeah.
It can either really work out well, like, you know, the Fantastic Four, where the kids basically became, you know, the
as
focus
powerful as
of
the parents.
Well, and became sort of the focus of the story in the Future Foundation mm-hmm. and stuff like that. And that stuff all worked, I thought, very well. Or it can really, you know, bog down the story.
Yep.
And so we'll see how it goes. But yeah, that show's been interesting too. I have not caught up on Riverdale, so I'll have to catch up on that one for next time that we do the boob tube.
Insane. This one is as insane as the season premiere.
Yeah. And you mentioned that, you know, obviously the Black Hood thing is pretty interesting and makes me want to go and revisit some of those comics because they're being very cagey, as yep. you might imagine, about who the identity is of this person. But I doubt that they're going to throw somebody completely new that we haven't met into that situation. I think this is somebody that was somehow wronged in the first season that is coming back to seek revenge in season two. That's
yep.
my thought about that. So, but in any case, yeah, so there you go. So that's your boob tube and big screen. That is going to do it for this episode of the Secret Identity Podcast. So for Mr. Matthew A. Herring, this is Brian Lantenry signing off. Have a great rest of your week, and we will talk to you in a few short days.
Bye-bye.
The rest of the comic publishing world may finally be arriving to the party, but Drive-Thru Comics is the one that started it all. The first downloadable comic shop is still leading the way when it comes to digital comics. Featuring hundreds of publishers, excellent prices, and top-notch customer service, Drive-Thru is a great experience all around. Another thing that sets Drive-Thru apart from a lot of other digital comics platforms is this. When you buy a comic, you own it. You get a watermarked PDF file that you can read on your laptop, your tablet, phone, or any other device. You choose how you enjoy the comics you buy. So head over to drivethroughcomics.com today, and on your way to checking out, download a free issue of Secret Identity.